and are not those of Northumberland 89.7. Agree, disagree, or have a comment? Call the station and speak with Dave live on the air. Call 905-372-2321. That's 905-372-2321. Now your host, Dave Glover.
Well, welcome back to the show, everybody, and thanks for joining us today on Remembrance Day. Joining us in the studio for your weekly installment of Consider This, of course, is Rob Washburn. He's professor of e-journalism at Loyalist College. And our two special guests in honor of Remembrance Day, Master Corporal Glenn Keefe and Corporal Tim Hoekstra, who are both, you're a reservist right now, right?
Yeah, I'm back in the reserves now.
He's back in the reserves after three tours in Afghanistan. And Glenn, you were actually at the Cenotaph last year. I understand you took over after Nathan Cirillo.
I was there from May till the latter part of April to the latter part of May.
Wow. Okay. So it's Remembrance Day. I guess the first question I have is how, and I guess we'll ask each of you in turn. We'll start with Glenn here. I mean, we grew up in Canada. You grew up like I did in Canada, where we really weren't involved in any kind of conflicts. Remembrance Day was really in the 80s, fewer and fewer people were attending the cenotaphs. But now we've seen just a resurgence. In the last 10 or so years, we've seen a huge number. Has Remembrance Day changed for you from when you were growing up and how you observed it to now, Glenn?
I think so. I remember growing up in Newfoundland, is where I grew up on the northeast coast, and I remember it was, you know, it was either a day off school or it was a something we did it like an assembly in school, and mm-hmm. a lot of people would explain why we were doing it, so it was just something to do. I think after my brother joined the military and becoming from a long line of military members, I see it as a more of a way of honoring those people and my family and what mm-hmm. have you like that. So now it's even more poignant because of attacks within Canada in the last year. Mm-hmm. So Remembrance Day for me has definitely changed over the years.
What about you, Tim? Has it changed? I mean, as I said, I mean, when I was growing up, like you in Canada, we weren't involved really in any kind of conflicts, peacekeepers for the most part. But now we have men and women who are active in the theater of combat. And I know growing up, I mean, for me, growing up, Remembrance Day was always important because of the relationship I had with my grandparents, who were both Second World War vets. My grandmother joined when she was 16, actually. She took the King's Shilling, as she likes to say. But, I mean, between that time and, say, Korea, there really wasn't anything. And there was this whole idea that, I mean, I remember Peter Mansbridge in the 80s saying, fewer and fewer people at the cenotaphs, is it going to go the way of the buggy whip? What was it like for you growing up, and has your view of Remembrance Day changed?
Oh, absolutely. I think similar to what Glenn was saying, in school, we just sort of did a token assembly to it, something like that. Mm-hmm. When I went to high school, I joined the Army Cadets, so then I became involved in it that way, and we would do the parade at the Cobourg's cenotaph. So at that time, I took it a lot more seriously. And also, dealing with the Legion and stuff, you see the older veterans, guys from Korea and World War II, and yes, that's how I saw it, is paying respect to the people who fought in the two world wars mostly and thanking them for the freedoms that we have, and also paying respect to the people that aren't here.
Well, now you're a part of that preservation of those freedoms, though, so the role has changed for you, hasn't it?
It has, and now, like, obviously I have a personal connection, having lost friends overseas, but to me, still, it's more about the contributions of the so-called greatest generation, the ones that we owe for that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's definitely more of a connection now, but I still view it the same way, I suppose.
Rob, what do you?
I was just curious too. I'd like to hear what Glenn has to say as an active service member, which is oftentimes on Remembrance Day. We really don't talk to people like yourselves who are active. We usually talk to people who are veterans who no longer serve in the same way. So could, maybe Glenn, you could enlighten us as to how you feel about it as an active service member.
It's. I think the nicest thing that you can have is someone to say thank you. This morning, just before we went and got ready for our Remembrance Day, a lady, I was in a line and a lady bought me a coffee. And, you know, she didn't have to, but she just wanted to say, it was a way of saying thank you. And those little things, those little moments when you're in uniform and someone stops to shake your hand, or they just do something like a random act of kindness to a soldier or an air person, airwoman, naval persons like that. It's just that way of feeling appreciated. And I think that in the last few years, since Afghanistan and in 2000, we've had that appreciation has been on the rise for military persons. And I have to say to Tim, you know, I have not gone overseas to be in theater, and you know, to sit next to him here, that's a privilege for me, because he's seen more than I've seen. But I know that we're all in that same combat of arms, that profession of arms, that we would look out for each other wherever we were. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I see that little thank you that we can give to each other.
Great.
Well, that's an interesting point. You talk about those folks that are in theater and the folks that aren't. And in Canada, it really is a choice, isn't it? We do afford that choice to our service personnel, do we not?
Yes, absolutely. And that's one thing that I stress to people who say, you know, oh, I could never do that or something like that, is that that's your call. But for me, it's always been a choice. You know, I volunteered for the Army. I chose the infantry. I applied for the Special Operations Regiment. I requested every single tour that I went on. I've been on four tours, and I would do it again. I would do some things differently, but it was all voluntary, and I think that's great that we have that privilege. We're able to do that. We don't have to have a you know, conscription or something like mm-hmm. that. You look at the military service, even in World War II, was the Canadian Army was massive. I don't recall the exact numbers, but it was a huge, huge percentage of the population volunteered for service and mm-hmm. made a truly massive contribution. So, yeah, it is voluntary, and that's something we have to mm-hmm. be thankful for because of those people and their sacrifices then.
Well, I'm not going to ask you about what your role was or any of that, but, I mean, you did three tours, you said?
Four.
Four tours in Afghanistan. How long is the tour?
6 months. With my unit, because of the manning, we're most regular force regular tours have what's called basically a leave. In the middle of it.
Like a furlough or something.
Yeah, basically it's 3 weeks at home.
Does that break in between?
Yeah.
Does that help?
Yeah, it's. I believe it does. Like, I know a lot of guys who've been on regular force tours and have had that, really appreciate it. But it can also be kind of a double-edged sword, because they have to spread it out throughout the tour. So some guys will get over there and do their 3 weeks, you know, after they've been there for a month, and then they have 6 months back home. Other guys won't do it until the end of the tour, but if you get it in the middle, you're good. But our tours, we didn't have that. We don't have enough people to support it, so it'd be about approximately 6 to 7 months at a time. So,
well, that's great. Now, of course, we've seen some interesting announcements coming out from our new Minister of Defense, and they're talking about the work they're doing now within the service to help folks reintegrate back into society, I guess you could say. Has that been an issue for you?
I'll try and answer that briefly. No, not so much. And there have been huge improvements. Even like every time I would come back, we go through a debriefing and reintegration period. And every time the briefings would have changed, you know, year to year, the mental health professionals and stuff, the interviews they do, they become more focused and they learn from previous iterations. We also, of course, are lucky to have lessons learned from America and the UK, Australia, other countries that are deploying people and returning them, so they're able to see what works and what doesn't.
Right. Well, on that note, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to ask the guys when we come back about how Remembrance Day was for them and where they both attended. And I know that I definitely want to ask Glenn about his time at the Cenotaph after that tragic event of October 22nd. So we will be right back. You are listening to The Drive Time right here on Northumberland 89.7. This is Canada's only holistic political chat. And welcome back to The Drive Time here on Northumberland 89.7. My guest in studio, Master Corporal Glenn Keefe, still an active service member, and Corporal Tim Hoekstra. Am I pronouncing that correctly, Jim?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And he is now a reservist, but was an active member of the forces, served four tours in Afghanistan. One of the things we were talking before during the last break was this idea of thanking a veteran. And, you know, you talked about how someone bought you a coffee there. And one of the things I've started to see with folks, and Tim, you can back me up on this, is this idea that, you know, they always say, oh, thank a veteran. If you enjoy your freedom, thank a veteran. But it is one of those uncomfortable things, isn't it?
Yeah, it can be for some. I know personally I find it that way, mostly because I don't know how to respond, but also because I didn't sign up expecting thanks or expecting, you know, a 10% discount at a hotel or a free coffee. I joined because I wanted to, you know, out of a sense of duty or feeling I wanted to serve,
mm-hmm.
But also because the job was something I wanted to do. So for me, for better or worse, you know, I went and did it, and I enjoyed it, my time
How old were you when you first joined the regular force?
Well, I joined in 2002 when I was 17. I believe I would have been 20. Mm-hmm. Yeah, about I think it was 20 or 21 when I went regular force.
Right. What about you, Glenn? How old were you when you joined?
I was 31.
31?
31.
Okay. Because I remember, you know, I was with the 48th Highlander Reserve Unit. I joined when I was 16. I lied about my age and did reserves for about a year and a half. And then I got really paranoid because I'd lied about my age and stopped going. I probably would get in trouble for that, actually, and I shouldn't be saying that over the air. But I, like you, always wanted to be in the service because my grandfather talked about it, and it wasn't glamorized. Like, I met a lot of veterans over my time, and one thing that was never done when I spoke to people who had served actively was there was never any of this glamorization. There was no Hollywood effect. There was reality. These guys talked about, you know, being awake for 3 and 4 days at a time because, you know, you have to be. And, you know, so but for me, it was always there was a calling there, you know. Like I said, I left the reserves. I tried to join up when I was 21. And this was in 87. And they told me I was too old. No, you're too old. Sorry. Which I thought it was odd, you know, because I guess they had enough guys then. But I think back then we had a standard. There was like a constitutionality into the size of the force. I think it was mandatory 80,000. That was the cutoff. There were reservists beyond the 80,000. But in terms of active force members, it was 80,000. Is that still the same way now, or have they changed that? Do you know?
It's not. Basically, you have each trade has an allotment. There's a certain number of people that can be in each trade. So you hear, like Glenn said, you know, when he joined, dental tech was open. They needed dental techs. Well, that's sort of the Army lingo for, you know, we need people. And when I joined, infantry was the same way. It was open. They didn't have enough people in any of the battalions or in any of the units, so mm-hmm. they needed recruits. Now, if you look at, like, 2009, 2010, the war in Afghanistan was going, receiving a lot of publicity, and a lot of people wanted to join combat arms. Mm-hmm. Most of the combat arms trades were closed because they were full, and the people that they had actually signed up to train were waiting sometimes up to a year after they'd done their initial application before they could go to basic training, for various reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But we still do have, you know, a set number of people per trade, per unit, but as far as I know, there's room, so to speak.
Still the best trained force on the planet, though, right?
Oh, sure.
Well, that was something I was always told. I was told this by many guys. I actually met a U.S. Marine once who was he was in Special Forces, and I can't remember what the unit was, but he said that when it comes to regular forces, beyond special units, yeah, there's lots of special units, and he said, but in terms of regular forces, the best trained regular force on the planet was the Canadian Armed Forces.
Yeah. I've worked with quite a few different nationalities and quite extensively with Americans, and they have a lot of respect for us and our capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
I'm curious about relations between veterans and those that are serving currently. Could you maybe characterize for us what that relationship's like, especially on a day like today?
Well, I'm not sure. Like recent veterans, or you know,
the older guys, the guys that we know that go down to the Legion, and
the greatest generation, if right. you will.
Yes.
Well, definitely, there's you know the degree of separation, but. Again, I don't like to go to the guys and say thanks for your service. Now that I've experienced that, what I do is if I can see them, I like to sit down with them and just you know, buy them a drink, have a couple drinks with them, shoot the bull and see what's...
Swap stories.
Exactly, if they want to,
mm-hmm.
you know. But just answer questions, ask questions, but try not to be too direct.
Is that do you have difficulty? I mean, are there people who just say to you, "Oh, well, you know, I know you're active. Can we sit down and have a couple of beers?" I mean, how readily are you to talk about?
I'm all right with that. I'm not. It's like to if I know them or whatever. But yeah, I don't have a problem really talking with anything. I just have to be mindful of my P's and Q's, I suppose.
How about you, Glenn? What's your relationship like?
It's a bit different, I guess, from my experience because, again, you know, when you're dealing with someone who's coming from theater and talking to someone who's always been in it, they can relate a little bit more because of the stories that they can tell and all that. So my relationship with a veteran would be more of the friendlier, not necessarily the war story type thing. You know, the sit down and talk to them and to me, I would say thank you because of the sacrifice that they give up. And if you look at what they came back for from overseas to Canada and dealing with maybe some of the issues that we're dealing with now that are coming arise within the Canadian forces, and not just ours, but other forces around the world and all that, and they didn't have the support that that we have today. It's still not great, but, you know, it's mm-hmm. getting better.
I've understood, though, that there's been tensions between older veterans and younger veterans and those who are serving currently, just because the experiences have been different and expectations are different, and a lot of focus goes on those who served in the First and Second World War compared to those who served in Korea, Vietnam, Afghanistan, those kinds of things. I'll start with you, Glenn, and then maybe Tim can come in. What's your experience with that, or how do you feel about that?
I think I've been to Ottawa twice now for the National Memorial Day Remembrance Day ceremonies, and the first time I went was in 2004, and from then to now, I think it's changed to the point where when the veterans would march, people would just kind of stand there and no one would do anything. They just watch them or whatever. That now it's applause because they think they realize of what's happened, the education mm-hmm. of what's going on from the Royal Canadian Legion, making it more of a time to reflect and those appreciative moments where someone is looking at that person who is, God love them, still walking if they can at this age, because we have no more Canadian World War I veterans left. We mm-hmm. just have World War II vets right now.
And they're all in their 90s now.
And they're all in their 90s now, yeah. So I think it's changed, because last year when I went to the National Remembrance Day service there, again, it was after Corporal Cirillo had been shot there and the goings-on in Ottawa. And the appreciation has gotten to be tenfold. I would say it's important now. People are realizing that we have no World War I vets left, and I think that that mortality is of remembrance is starting to set in.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, Tim?
Well, I think as to your question about whether there's any conflict or I guess resentment,
tension, maybe
tension. Yeah, it's good between more recent veterans and. The older generation of veterans, I haven't seen it personally. I've heard of it anecdotally.
Mm-hmm.
What I have seen is definitely a disconnect, especially with younger veterans and the Legion. You know, the Legion used to be, it was started as a place for veterans to meet,
mm-hmm.
you know, and hang mm-hmm. out with each other, that sort of thing. I don't believe there's any Afghan veterans in the Cobourg Legion. I don't know, most of the veterans that I know, even when they get out, do not join the Legion. They don't really find it relevant. You look at the Legion, and it's a lot of people who have not served, or and I'm not saying that they shouldn't let other people in. I'm just saying that now, more recent veterans don't really see that it's relative to them. I guess
should the Royal Canadian Legion then be doing more to in terms of outreach for returning soldiers?
I don't know. I don't know what they could do. Like, we actually, when we were overseas, we got some parcels around Christmas time from the Legion, the White Horse Yukon Legion, and that was cool. It's just stuff like that. But I don't think it's. I don't have a solution, mm-hmm. so I'm hesitant to criticize. But I will say that the problem I see is not the older generation of veterans, it's the younger generation of veterans.
They don't see the relevance.
Well, it's that, but it's also certain individuals who are looking for attention, more or less. These are the guys who went overseas and then they walk around wearing an Army shirt or a veteran shirt, asking for a discount here and there. They feel like they need more recognition, and they feel those are the ones who feel like the Legion or the older veterans are getting too much of it. I don't think they are. I believe that, you know, like you said, that greatest generation, the World War II veterans and World War I, if we had them, you know, when you look at it, World War II was really the last conflict that you can say we really fought for our own freedoms or protection of our own freedoms. Since then, every conflict we've been in to help others. But, you know, even Korea, Afghanistan, Vietnam, the various peacekeeping missions to Africa, the Middle East, were there assisting and helping other people and trying to improve their way of life.
Right.
And we need to keep that in mind. Like in World War II, everybody, these guys all signed up to protect Canada and the Canadian way of life.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're trying to help everyone else, but it's still, there's by no means should we downplay their contributions or try and
mm-hmm.
pull more towards.
Well, it's a question that I've asked myself, the one that you asked, Rob, because I've been a member of the local branch here for 15 years, actually, and it's about time to pay my dues, come to be honest with you. But, I think in my mind, anyway, there is a disconnect between that, if you will, greatest generation of soldiers and the guys who are serving. Now, there really is, and a lot of that has to do with generational issues, and maybe they don't understand. But one of the other things I think is different now for active members is, you know, when they were serving in Vietnam and Korea and North and First and Second World War, or Second World War only, I guess we'll talk about, we didn't get immediate news. Nobody knew what was going on over there for weeks at a time. We didn't have the immediacy of 24-hour news cycles. I mean, when something happens in Kandahar 8 hours ago, we'll know about it. And we get that immediate. And so I think there's probably a huge difference in the way the public reacts now to the way it was being portrayed then. Plus, of course, back then, everything was being controlled by the government. They were controlling what the message is. Right. Is that something you find difficult to deal with, though? The fact that everyone's sort of already, I already know what it's like. People have this feeling because of television and news that they understand. Oh, I know what you went through, man. I've seen the photos, you know?
Well, the easiest way I can reply to that is with one of my favorite Mark Twain quotes, which is, if you don't read the newspaper, you're uninformed. And if you do read the newspaper, you're misinformed. So still today, and I've seen it personally, I've been on missions and seen what happened and then seen news reports the next day or within several days that tell an entirely different story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, media manipulation or whatever. It is what it is.
Mm-hmm. That's got to be frustrating, though.
Mostly it's amusing.
Yeah.
But it's just now we're seeing a bit that journalism has to be more honest, I guess, about that sort of thing, because with everyone having a camera or camera phone in their pocket, you can try and spin things how you want them, but there's going to be three other versions of it on YouTube already, or three copies of the version that actually happened, sort of thing. So I think definitely the reporting is getting more direct, but yeah. It's
I thought you made a really interesting point about the type of service, though. You know, in the Second World War, what they went over, what they were fighting for, a totally different motivation than the things that are motivating people like yourselves who are currently serving and the types of missions that you're doing. I'd like to hear maybe, Glenn, what you have to say about that that perspective and how does that change public perception and our whole feeling and thinking about military service.
When I joined, I thought, I could be sent anywhere. I mean, even as a dental technician, you know, we're your soldier first, trade second type thing like that. And I've even put in a memo to go overseas, and I would go in a heartbeat to make a difference in a world, whatever like that. Perception, you know, a picture paints 1,000 words. You know, whenever you're looking at anything and what you read, you know, and what you say and what you do, again, can be interpreted in so many different ways. So how we as a military go into, I mean, Canada has always been known as a peacekeeping force, and we were always a peacekeeping force for many, many years until Afghanistan. I mean, 9/11 really changed the world and changed the idea of how Canada was looked at. And mm-hmm. then when we did not go into Iraq, but did go into Afghanistan, it was an eye-opener for a lot of people, and 158 Canadians did not come back from that. I mean, I had a friend of mine who was on my basic training who didn't come back from that, and he was 23 years old. So those perceptions of what war is and what the public see, it's still someone taking up an arm and standing on guard and saying, you know something, no one's going to get hurt on my watch. And you and that's what you stand there for, whether it be for Canadian values or someone else's values. But I mean, again, the Second World War was such it was a poignant conflict. Our technology had gotten better. I mean, like, wars are fought with computers today. It's still a rifle and still a bullet and still, you know, and arms and all that. But it's more of a technological warfare than it is, you know, an armed warfare.
But I also think you look at it and Canadians were engaged in a different way as well. I mean, in the First and Second World Wars, you had the lists coming back and you'd read the paper and see who had gone. And people were involved in initiatives to, you know, drives to get, you know, metal and cloth and you know, people participated in a different way. And then there were a number of years where Canadians weren't engaged, you know, Korea, mm-hmm. the peacekeeping missions, the public wasn't as attuned to it. But then through things like the Highway of Heroes and also things like that, I think all of us are sort of tuned in on a different level, even though it's a different kind of mission. And I think that's made a difference. I'm curious though, how would you like to see your efforts remembered 50 years from now? Tim, what do you think?
You know what? I'm perfectly fine with it just being another banner on the cenotaph. Because at the end of the day, that's what it is. Afghanistan was just another mission that we contributed to try and improve the lives of others. It's, you know, it's the most recent. It stands out in our minds, and I agree. It is a little bit different in how it was portrayed. Like you said, you know, we were painted as a peacekeeping force right up until Afghanistan. But really, the job didn't change drastically. We were just allowed to take the gloves off because the whole term peacekeeping, well, if you have peace, you don't really need warriors to keep it, but if you don't have peace, you need peace or warriors to establish it and maintain it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's another quote. I want to say it's Sun Tzu, but I don't think so. If you want peace, prepare for war. So you can't, you know, deplete the military, as we saw happen with our tanks being sold off just prior to Afghanistan, or heavy lift helicopters being sold off, and then when a conflict comes where we decide that we need them, well, we got to scramble and try and recover them again. Mm-hmm. I think that the term peacekeeping really took a lot of, or got a lot of momentum when the Canadian forces was being seriously downsized in the 70s, 60s and 70s, and it was more of a way to justify it, saying, well, we're peacekeepers, we don't need aircraft carriers, we don't need a massive military mm-hmm. structure. So we're going to downsize. We're going to concentrate on peacekeeping. And, you know, that the peacekeeping missions that we've participated in have bolstered Canada's reputation internationally, and we're known for that, and I believe we should continue to do it. But we still need to maintain the ability to fight, because if you go into an area like Afghanistan to try and create and maintain peace, well, you need to be able to fight to do that.
Mm-hmm. On that note, we're going to take our last break of the hour, folks. You're listening to The Drive Time right here on Northumberland 89.7. I'm your host, Dave Glover. With me are Master Corporal Glenn Keefe, Corporal Tim Hoekstra, and, of course, Rob Washburn, Professor of E-Journalism at Loyalist College. We will be right back.
It's like, for me or anything else, that I'm quite happy just to have done my service and to say, you know, something, I did something to make a difference. I think that's I can't speak for every person that's in the Canadian Armed Forces, but personally, when I joined, I wanted to make a difference. And if in my tenure of my 20 years of service, and I've done that, you know, something, I've done my job. In the 50 years, 100 mm-hmm. years, I've served my country.
Well, and that's a great response. And I think, Tim, you were saying pretty much the same thing, though, right? I mean,
yeah, I agree.
As far as the service goes. Now, one of the things we talked about during the break is the difficulty of keeping the peace in a region where oftentimes if the people help you to maintain the peace, then they're branded as collaborators. They're basically got a target on their backs. It's got to be difficult to protect people who, for their own safety, won't accept your protection.
Well, it's you could say that, yes, but on the other hand, they're protecting themselves by refusing our protection.
Mm-hmm.
Like we were speaking of Afghanistan in particular. So where we were living out in the rural areas, you know, houses and compounds all around yourself, the locals are a stone's throw away. Literally, I could throw a stone and hit the next house with locals in it. Now, if they would help us, they would be considered an enemy by the Taliban, who would not hesitate to kill them when they were given the opportunity. Now, if they were to support the Taliban, either passively or actively, it's not like we would just go into their house at night and kill them. You know, we might know that they weren't supporting us, but there's nothing we could do about it unless they actually pick up a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
So, personally, if it was me, the choice would be pretty simple. I side with the guys that probably won't kill you, or side with the guys that definitely will if you don't. And like I said, they have seen the Soviets in their country. They've seen us. They far enough back, the Brits were there, and mm-hmm. and whoever else before then, they believe that we would just go there short term and then be gone. So
do they see us as an invading force, though, like the Russians in the 80s? Is that the mindset, or just another country that's coming
in some areas? Yes, yeah. It's definitely different. But it would depend on the individual. You would see individual families and individual villages depend on their experience. You know, if they had had loss, to a bombing, somebody's house had been blown up or something by the Americans or us, well, they would be anti-coalition.
Mm-hmm.
If, on the other hand, someone's kids had hit an IED and died, well, they might be anti-Taliban. So I don't believe they saw us as invaders, again, because we were out there in the dealing with them day to day. But they certainly didn't view us as equals, if that makes sense.
So it's almost like living in a biker town, if I can use that analogy. Because I had a guy in here a little while ago. He's talking about living in Smiths Falls, and in Smiths Falls is pretty much the town's controlled by bikers.
Okay.
You can call the police if you want, but odds are, you know, the guys who are really in control. And sounds to me like that's what you're saying. You know, the military's there. You guys are essentially the police force. You're there to bring peace and then maintain that peace. But then at the same time, the people you're there to protect are saying, look, you know what? I don't want to be identified with you guys. I don't want to have my picture taken with any of you guys, seen talking to you, because then I know I've got a target on my back. And it's that's got to be frustrating.
Oh, absolutely frustrating.
You know? I mean,
I have a last question just as we're going. We're coming out of our time. I'd just like you to define for me what patriotism means to you.
Oh, wow.
Good thing it's an easy one.
You want to go, too?
Oh, yeah, thank you. You know, honestly, I don't know if I could answer this properly on the spot like this. It, I guess it's pride in the country, the country's accomplishments, history, not so much the geographical location, but like what we've done so far, our Canadian attitudes, Charter of Rights and Freedoms, stuff like that.
Are our attitudes that much different from those of the U.S. soldiers, having served with U.S. soldiers there? Do you find there's a difference like is there a difference in mentality between what an American soldier is there for and what a Canadian soldier is there
for? Can't really just call them all American soldiers. We worked with several different units. I've worked with Marines, like regular Marines. I've worked with guys from Force Recon or the MARSOC, as they call it now.
Mm-hmm.
We work with guys from 101st Airborne and 1st Special Forces Group. Most of those guys are equals, but then there are some groups that are not so much. They have a very different attitude, outlook, and level of training. But
what's your answer, Glenn?
Sorry, yeah.
I think myself, just listening to Tim there, you know, it's patriotism to me is the fact that the job I've done, if it's made a difference and to make someone else's life easier. So, I mean, whether I do it here or overseas or on a humanitarian mission, if I can let somebody know, like, if someone sees a Canadian flag and says, you know something, those are good people, they've got good things, then I think that's what would mean to me, is just the fact that we're in one of the greatest countries in the world, and we just want to keep it that way and be able to help and make a difference.
Thank you so much.
Well, I want to thank both of you guys for being here. Really, really a great pleasure, frankly, to get to talk to both of you. My guests have been Corporal Tim Hoekstra, who is a reservist right now, and was an active member of the Canadian Forces, and Master Corporal Glenn Keefe, who is still an active member of the Canadian Forces. This has been our Remembrance Day show right here on Northumberland 89.7. This has been The Drive Time. Rob Washburn, always a wonderful contribution to us here on Consider This Live. We're going to take you out right now with Donovan and Universal Soldier from 1965.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds, he says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Lobau? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon of the war, and without him, all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more. They come from here and there, and you and me. And brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put the end to war.